Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. Hey, this is Kat, Communications Director of HRN, here with a preview of Episode 2 of Meat and 3. This week, we're talking pork. We'll learn the best way to make a BLT.
I don't think I've ever successfully made a BLT just because I eat the bacon before any other part.
How pitmasters and restaurateurs are helping put small-scale pig farmers back to work in Alabama.
It's all about money. That's the bottom line.
What pork has to do with economics?
Farmers could be particularly affected by China's threat to levy its own tariffs on pork and soybeans.
And with government.
Basically, all of politics is pork at this point.
So tune in on Friday afternoon for your weekly serving of Meat and Three, and make sure you subscribe to be the first to know when new episodes air.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 in the Good Beer Seal. Today is Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. We've been doing this show for a long time. I think it's our ninth year. Well, we've been talking a lot this year about the Cicerone program, advanced Cicerones. We've had some higher level New York City industry people that have taken the tests. And we finally have some of our master Cicerones who are based in the New York area. And that's a really exciting show. We've got Max Becker and Rylan Daly, who both work for the high-end division of AB. So you guys, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you on. And you're also joined. Let's just everyone say their name. And once again, Master Cicerone.
Yeah, I'm Max Becker. Thank you for having us.
Master Cicerone.
Ryan Daly. Thanks, Jimmy.
And Certified Cicerone.
Lacey Clifford.
Hey. All right. So you guys answered the call, and thanks for coming out. Yeah. But it is interesting. You know, we've got... You know, if not generations, centuries of sommelier certificates. And even I took a Sommelier Society of America course in the 80s. It's great to see how far the Cicerone program has come. I mean, 12 years ago at Jimmy's Number 43, a guy named Sam Merritt, who you might know from Las Vegas now, he was teaching a certified a server class for Cicerone when it was just really starting out. And now there's advanced Cicerone, and we've done a couple of shows about that. But let's just talk about what the Master Cicerone means to you guys, because you guys went out and you passed it, and you know your jobs are like beer educators, which is kind of what you know that role I guess is meant to be. And we're also gonna do some beer quiz. We've got a lot of questions related to the Master Cicerone syllabus, which I know is very challenging. So let's start, Max, just say a few things about why did you go for the Master Cicerone and how grueling it was to get it.
Yeah, so it's a huge challenge. I was kind of tapped, and they said, hey, do you want to take this test? And I heard all the horror stories and finally got on the internet, and I didn't find a lot about it. Not a lot of people are talk about it. It's very close to the cuff. I went on the Reddits of the world, the Google, and I didn't see a lot. And
How many Master Cicerones are there in the world?
There's 16 That's as Ryan. We speak. Yep.
Only 16. So maybe that's why there's not a lot of talk about it. We know at Malty Rich on Instagram, Rich Higgins has been on the show a couple of times. And Mirella
Amato.
Amato in Toronto, who mm-hmm. is, what's her, how do you know her hashtag, at something?
Beerology, maybe?
Beerology. She's in Toronto. We've been buddies. But yeah, man. 16 Master Cicerones in the world. Dudes, congratulations. This show's been Thank months you. In the making, yeah. And thanks, Lacey, for bringing you in. And for you, Ryan, what was your... So, Max, you got tapped? They just say, you have the IQ and the...
So I moved from San Francisco to New York to take an education role, and it was... It basically said, go out and become a master Cicerone, which to me, I was like, oh, that's okay. No pressure. I always joke that it took about 2 years and 30 pounds, and I finally did it, but now I'm trying to get back in the fighting way here. So
you were working in beer, but you really spent 2 years studying for it.
Yeah, I was working in beer doing sales and marketing in Northern California, and I really had to commit almost 2 years of 60 plus hours a week sometimes, just reading, tasting, reading, writing notes, forgetting, remembering, and kind of
Drinking.
Lots of samples.
I looked at this, the Master Cicerone syllabus online. Big shout out to Ray Daniels. I've never met you, but Lucy Saunders, I know, is your buddy out in Midwest. A lot of great people. Really, really, you know, congratulate you on what you've done building up this program. And Ryan, tell us your journey on this. How did you get tapped to take it in the first place?
Sure. So, you're
up in Buffalo, New York, right?
Yep, just outside Hamburg, New York, which is a suburb of Buffalo. For me, you know, I took the level 2, the certified Cicerone exam in 2012. And after I did that, you know, at the time, I wasn't necessarily thinking about going for master. This was before the advanced level even existed. And it's kind of one of those things. Are you up for the challenge? Do you have enough time, effort to put into it? But also you kind of question, do you just have what it takes to pass it, right? I mean, at this point, there wasn't even maybe half the number that there are now. And then for me, when they first introduced the advanced exam, I sat for the first exam in February of 2016. And when I passed the advanced, it kind of gave me the confidence, you know, after studying for a few months for that, I said, you know what, if I put in the time, you know, I think I could maybe give the master a run. And I put together a, you know, another year and a half study plan. And fortunately, Max was my predecessor, so I was able to use him as a soundboard and just gave it a run and thankfully was able to pass.
Oh, that's great. And Lacey, you helped put together the show. These guys work with you. What's the importance of having Master Cicerones as beer educators? You know, how do you see them in the industry?
Oh, my gosh. Well, no one knows more than these guys. I mean, when you take these guys anywhere on a tasting or to meet people, everyone is amazed at how much they didn't know about beer and how much more there is to discover. It's pretty cool.
And how good-looking we are.
That's right.
Well, also, you guys have your natural speakers and great, you know, media people. You know, world, watch out for the Master Cicerones. A few years ago, it was like our buddy from the brewery, Patrick Rue in California, became a Master Cicerone. And some people were surprised. I don't think we knew that he was actually taking it. But it also made sense that, oh, he's a brewer, has a lot of deep knowledge, that he would do that. But are most of you guys more in terms of like you're almost academics and you're educators more than actually working brewers?
Yeah, I'd say it's a little split. You know, you have a few people that work specifically for brewery, like Patrick, a few of the BrewDog guys. You have a few people that work directly for the Cicerone program. Some people are just doing consultancy and kind of their own gig. Max and I do a lot of education, obviously, with the high end. So there's not, it's one of those things where everybody asks, well, if you pass, what happens? What do you become? What's the job after the fact? And it's really not one thing. I think everybody kind of goes down a different path, but ultimately we're all kind of celebrating beer and kind of paying forward just how amazing beer is. Yeah.
I do think having a different background helps you with the exam, though. I heard Patrick had a law background. I have a background in classical studies, which means I can memorize a lot of things and then quickly forget them. Help working at a brewery helps because it kind of takes a village, and almost every person you see that works in the brewery industry, at the time I was studying, I asked, hey, do you know this? Have you seen this? Can I smell that? Can I taste that? So it was picking the brains of everybody I met for 2 years to kind of almost be like a symbiote and just take out their knowledge to get past the hump of the 85% you need to pass the test.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it definitely was not an individual effort. I mean, Max was huge with me, but, you know, I had a small study group of three other guys that were taking the exam with me. So we were able to bounce some ideas, bounce information off each other. You know, one of the guys, Gavin Harper, who ended up passing, brewmaster, incredibly smart guy. Joe Vogelbacher owns a brewery down in Charlotte. James Ty works here locally in the city.
We know James very well.
Yeah. So, in addition to just those guys, kind of my inner circle, I mean, obviously the guys that are in the women that are writing the books, you're doing in-person trainings, in-person tastings, things like that. So you definitely have to be in that mindset where you're just a sponge and you're absorbing everything you can on all things beer.
You know, some of the topics that we've talked about over the years have never been addressed properly, which I'm hoping the Master Cicerones can address. Yeah. Our first one is descriptive terms in tastings. You know, we've had a lot of people who have done BJCP tastings. And, you know, going back in the 19th century, people, especially in France with wine, lived on farms and they had horses. And they used words like barnyard or horse blanket. And then it seems more recently, younger people might say there's a Lucky Charms note or a cereal, you know, references, you know. How does that relate to really what we're tasting, you know, in our glass? Because isn't that a big part of what you guys do, is describing what you're tasting?
Yeah, and I'll take it first, then Max can weigh in. Yeah, I think as you work your way up in the levels of the Cicerone ladder, you definitely, the expectation is you become much more adept and descriptive with what you're perceiving. So I'll just give you an example. Let's just say you smell a beer and you say it's fruity. Okay, well, what kind of fruit? It's citrus fruit. Okay, well, what kind of citrus fruit? It's orange. Okay, is it orange peel? Is it orange pith? Things like that. So as you kind of work your way up, you just have to continue to drill deeper and deeper and become more descriptive. Mm. And that applies to everything from malt, hop, fermentation, flavors, aromas, things like that. So not only your ability to, you know, articulate that, but your ability to essentially identify that in any beer that's put in front of you.
And then kind of going up from that, you almost have to get to a point where you have to commit to learn the specific flavor compounds. So, you know, we just came back from a week in Charlotte training with Aroxa. Just always is a constant refresh. But as Dr. Simpson says, if you smell, say,
4-ethyl...
Dr. Simpson, probably one of the top tasters in the world, runs a company called Cara Technologies, Aroxa, which create flavor standards for water, wine, milk, beer. So he can take 32 ounces of beer, spike it with, say, 4-ethyl phenol, which is one of the main phenolic compounds in Brett beers. And you really can taste it, smell it, and commit it to memory. And the way he describes it is, you know, this is 4-ethyl phenol. You know, the industry says it could smell like horse blanket, fermented olives. But if you smell it, like...
I like that, fermented olives. But yeah. I want that.
Yeah, yeah. In his mind, he says, you know, if you see a color or if you even have a memory, as long as you can associate that back to this being 4-ethyl phenol, that's the truest way to become a better taster is really get to the nuts and bolts. And then you associate something, and you can't take the group's association, it's your own unique perspective.
Yeah, and I think just to build off of that, you know, one of the things that's unique as you're being tested within the Master Cicerone exam is, you know, they're testing you to identify specific flavors by compound name, right? But how many people, if we walk around this bar right now and say, hey, does smell this 4-ethyl phenol, right, outside of Max and I, most people are going to be like, what the hell are you talking about? So they're also
saying it sounds better than horse blanket.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Lazy, right? You're like,
yeah, but at the same time, they test
the science behind it.
They test you to put it into very consumer friendly language. Right. And I think ultimately that's kind of the goal of anybody that's a Cicerone, whether it be certified, advanced, master, is, yeah, you know, you can get super beer geeky and technical, but at the same time, you're really just trying to get more and more people excited about beer and doing that in a way that they can easily understand and easily have a point of reference to.
Yeah, one of the biggest things we do, even taking BJCP tests and doing a lot of tasting training, is we always tell people we're going to take them from the subjective to the objective. So if you tell me this beer tastes like this, we should be able to go across the street to Whole Foods, taste the fruit, taste the herb, taste the cookie, taste the cracker, and it should be apples to apples. Subjective tasting, it's a lot of poetry, but it doesn't help people learn flavors, and especially consumers, you know. That's Ryan said, people could say, oh, it tastes like citrus. Oh, I hate citrus. Oh, it tastes like grapefruit. I love grapefruit. So getting more descriptive and more objective is kind of the key goal we train people to do and constantly train ourselves to learn more about.
That's great. So it's just like a higher level of communicating. I mean, it's an off subject is like people from the Midwest often don't like fish. I'm from New England. I love fish. And it's the same kind of thing. You just made me realize this. Subject of conversation. Oh, do you like fish? Some people say no. Some people say yes.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went to Hawaii and had shave ice. I was like, what are these flavors? It's not watermelon or honeydew melon. It's lilikoi and lychee and all these other things that I was not exposed to. So if I read that on a piece of paper, I'd... Before so
maybe some of those tropical fruits smell like horse blanket,
right?
Sometimes, right?
Yeah.
But you guys are cool. And Lacey, being around these guys, you know, are you learning from them?
Well, Ryan actually was my teacher when I was studying for certified Cicerone, so I definitely learned everything I know from these guys. That's for sure.
And what kind of situations are they put in? So you're working with retail accounts. Training, industry, salespeople. What are some of the actual jobs that you guys do as Master Cicerones?
Sure. So, you know, we kind of train people across what we would just say is beer-based topics. So it might be flavor, tasting, ingredients, process, pairing beer and food. And then we also try and train people on some of the beers, the breweries within our portfolio. So those are kind of our two wheelhouse spaces, and we'll do that with internal sales reps, whether it be just high-end AB or from some of our breweries. We'll work with our wholesalers. Sometimes state-dependent might do things with retailers, maybe some consumer events. So it's a little bit of a full spectrum of who we'll work with and who we'll train. But for the most part, it all comes back to either beer or what we'll say brewery or brand.
And everyone's always excited too, no matter who it is. They're like,
there's a lot of knowledge. Yeah. I mean, I actually want to go more with this. I just like how you just, you know, help me understand when we're talking about language. You just said about some people like citrus and they don't. You have to get more. Is it getting more descriptive, or is it being less descriptive?
I think it's getting more descriptive because everyone has a different lexicon, and it's kind of said like citrus is such a broad category, tropical is such a broad category, red fruits is such a broad category. So it's getting more descriptive to where people are like, you know, I love raspberries, but I hate blueberries, or I like apricots.
I like that. That's me. Yeah,
but I hate peaches. So
I like this guy.
Even as you describe beer, you know, as you're a bar putting a menu description on paper, you know, thinking about that, or even how we call beer sour, that turns a lot of people away from trying great, great beers. But, you know, if you said it tastes like Greek yogurt, people will be like, well, I love Greek yogurt, or tastes like kombucha. And people will say, you know, drink that every day. So
I got my own SCOBY.
Yeah, you got my own SCOBY. Yeah. So it's a lot about...
Hey, Ryan, say that again one more time.
I got my own SCOBY.
That's the best line so far. Yeah.
That's a good cut.
Yeah.
It's getting down to just relating it to food. Because, you know, at the end of the day, beer is a food product. There's so many flavors that go from beer to food and food to beer that breaking it down, it's just beer. And there's all these great flavors, whether it's in the malt, the hops, the water, the yeast. And just finding ways to be technical, but also just relate them to the average person. And I think it's going to bring more people into the category when we stop being, trying to be as fancy as the wine world and use more just everyday language, like tastes like Greek yogurt.
Right? We're on to a roll. This is going great. Quick shout out, what's beer is in our glass?
So we are drinking a Goose Island Lolita from the year of our Lord, 2013 here.
It's so good.
It was at the Three Sisters series?
Yeah.
Part of the Sour Sisters. Lolita is aged in wine barrels, put about 50 pounds of fresh raspberries, a little bit of wild yeast. So, yeah, you get this nice fresh raspberry jam-like quality, but then there's also kind of this nice tart, sweet tart, chalky taste and texture to it as well. It's pretty delicious.
All right. Great. That's a great start. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member and check out the new Meetin' 3 weekly news series. I don't know if it's weekly yet, but it should be. You guys got to keep it going. It's weekly, David. Good job. But you've got a pork show up, and I'm sure you'll have some beer shows with us. Meetin' 3 on Heritage Radio Network. So we got the guys here, Mass Cicerone, soon to be called Yoda, Max Backer, and Ryan Daly. And Lacey, who's on her way up. She'll be a master's.
Oh, yeah.
But we're going to get deeper into some of the Master Cicerone syllabus because I'm sure a bunch of listeners want to ask you guys questions. So just from the syllabus, you know, one of the points is the historical development of beer styles. You know, what's an example of a tax or regulatory impact that really changed a beer style in some time in history? I mean, we know there's some that everyone talks about. But there's probably others that you guys had to study. And I'm actually curious how many of these examples you guys studied or were in the test, too.
Yeah, I mean, from tax, I mean, I might go to like the English Pale Ales where, you know, they started to tax beers by gravity. And, you know, you originally, when you kind of had the onslaught of English IPAs and, you know, higher 6%+ alcohol, and then with a little bit of temperance, wartime to where...
So kind of going from 1800s into the 1900s.
Early 1900s, yeah, where all of a sudden, you know, that grain, it needs to be used for other services. So you start taxing brewers on the gravity. So essentially, you know, what's going to determine the level of alcohol for the most part in the beer. It takes a lot of grain to get that higher level of gravity. So if you're being taxed on how much you're using, you're going to start to...
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I know that we've had like 19th century, you know, English beer styles, like Ron Pattinson talks about, this writer, and they were like, they were bigger, hoppier, you know, beers. And so is it our perception of like what an English pale ale is because of that change?
Well, you kind of have...
Because everyone thinks it's like this mild, kind of easy drinking ale.
Sure. Well, there's what we would refer to as like the British, the bitters, kind of a ladder there. So... very similar DNA, malt bill, hop bill, yeast, but you're just kind of dialing up a little bit more alcohol, a little bit more bitterness. So you have, you know, your ordinary, your best, your strong bitter, aka ESB. Then you get into like the English IPAs of the world. So in terms of the inputs of the beer, the grain, the hops, the yeast, very similar, but you're just kind of dialing things up on a few different rungs of the ladder. So that's kind of a good example. You know, if you think of Scottish ale, same thing. You know, you have very similar inputs.
Tell us, we don't know Scottish. So I knew not if everyone. Did you know about the change in English ales based on tax and regulation? Did you know that, Max?
Before I started reading, it wasn't on my university course circuit. But I think one of the things I found out studying was like, as long as there's been beer taxes. Which was interesting, and going back to Scotland, you know, finding out that part of the unification of Scotland and England was that Scotland wasn't going to pay any tax on malt or gravity. So, because they were making a lot of high gravity beers, they're also making a lot of scotch. So you have some styles up there that were allowed to evolve and stay higher alcohol, like your scotch ale or wee heavy.
But that was like a political trade-off.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we always reference a little Braveheart before we get into it, but,
So this is you were bringing this up. This is something that you guys usually talk about in this context.
Yeah, to a certain degree, and it depends. You know, if we're doing a training for certified Cicerone, they're probably not going to dig too deep into specifics of tax implications on style development. But you certainly need to know kind of the overall anatomy of any style that's listed on the syllabus, and that comes down to, you know, stats and ingredients and anything unique in process, flavor profiles. Things like that. But things that happen with tax, temperance, maybe just local ingredients that were available at the time, the local water profile, all is going to kind of roll up into the types of beers that were being made.
So we've talked English ales, Scottish means Scotch ales, mm-hmm. and stayed strong. A couple more examples of that.
Well, to me, what I really find fascinating in terms of style development is the impact of local water profile on styles that came to be. So as you kind of learn a little bit more about water chemistry, you learn a little bit more about, you know, certain minerals, certain ions, and, you know, how they impact the pH of a beer and what that does in the brew house, what that might do in fermentation, other minerals that might be there that accentuate hop character versus malt character. And as you start to see styles, so let's just take Dublin, for example. So when you think of Dublin, Jimmy, what sort of beer do you think about?
I don't want to say, but most people say Guinness.
Yeah, just Irish stout in general. Yeah, so Guinness.
Irish stout, that's right.
Right, so, you know, a lot of black malt, roasted barley. You know, so Dublin's known to have a very high...
You're not supposed to ask me questions.
Right? Yeah, no, I had to get you one. You know, we're going to throw it back at you. And not to get kind of too geeky into water chemistry, but Dublin has very high levels of bicarbonate, which... you know, really impacts the pH, the alkalinity of the beer. So, you know, the only types of beer they could make at the time, this is before water adjustment technology existed, was using heavy amounts of roasted malts, roasted barley, to really dial in some of those key metrics that are necessary to produce a pretty clean, balanced beer. And you can go into Munich and find examples. You can go into Pilsen, Burton-on-Trent. So to me, I really kind of enjoy more how the just raw ingredients and the availability of the raw ingredients to certain styles played such a key role in where those styles came from and, you know, pretty much why they work so well.
And for some of those, they're not working with modern technology, so it was trial and error and taste. They made a beer. They knew, you know, if we use too much of X or too much of Y, it doesn't taste to the how we want it to be. And if we don't like it, then our consumer won't like it. So it's interesting going back to Munich and making these dark beers, these Dunkels. And when they figured out and when they found out that the technology and the methodology to make lighter beers like German Pilsners or Czech premium pale lagers, used to be called the Bohemian Pilsner, their palate wasn't liking it. So they had to make a lighter version of a darker beer. So it's interesting how just because you can doesn't mean you should. So some places liked the lighter beer, but they didn't dig the bitterness.
The Dunkel that was just like
So the Dunkel is the godfather of Munich beers. And then in 1894...
I love Dunkel. Yeah. Amber, Dunkel lagers.
Yeah, they're the one beer that no one's ever had, I say, because until you have a fresh Dunkel, it'll change your life. Fresh right from the brewery. But once they came out with the Munich Helles in 1894, the Spaten Brewery, you know, people were a little hesitant at first and eventually caught on, but it's got a similar kind of sweet to bitter profile as the Dunkel minus some of the kind of pretzel.
So you're saying in Munich it took them a long time they resisted.
Yeah, so they resisted coming from their neighbors to the east, and you know in Prague the 1842 rolled out the barrel of a Pilsner Kell and said to the world we're making clear hoppy beer that's very fantastic, and Germans being that was their industry, so Northern Germany started catching on and making similar style to the Czech beer, lighter and malt character, more attenuated, things like that. And in Munich, it took them a little bit. And then when they switched over, they didn't go for a big hoppy dry beer. They went for, you know, what I consider to be the best beer style in the world, a Munich Helles. So, oh yeah, if one beer could be my spirit animal, Jimmy, that's the Munich Helles. So
that's good. You might be the next Yoda. Right. I want to shout out you guys on Instagram. It's at Master C Max and at Master C Ryan. Actually, I don't know if you. Can you reference any books that you've read or studies just on this topic alone of the history of beer styles?
I mean, there's a lot of good books. I mean, Tasting Beer by Randy Mosier's one that covers a pretty good spectrum of all things beer, and he gets into styles a little bit. Probably the one that I think is really well done and somebody that I really enjoy reading is Jeff Allworth, The Beer Bible.
Love that guy.
Yeah. You know, I've met him, I sat next to him at a beer dinner years ago. Just really down to earth, really fun to hang out with, talk beer. And this is before I knew, you know, a fraction of what I know now. Not that I know much. But I'd say when it comes to styles, kind of the history, the story behind a lot of styles, The Beer Bible by Jeff Allworth is definitely worth a pickup.
Yeah. I second that.
Yeah.
And we did a show with him a couple of years ago. So
I think Tasting Beer is probably, it's where I really got into reading and learning about beer. I mean, I had a dog-eared cover that I lost, but it came out with the second edition, which I haven't read yet. I'm looking forward to doing that. I was just counting the books I read this morning for taking the test. I think it was like 60. And I would say if you're studying for the Master System exam, be very careful. If you read a few chapters, there's a fine line between like a kind of fun read and something that is providing you the information for the test. So the story aspect of it isn't as needed for the test as the, you know, what's the components of the beer? What are the commercial examples? What's the grist bill and all those things? So, but it's a good respite sometimes to just read a book and say, you know, I went cover to cover in 2 hours and I really enjoyed the stories. Now I still have to check them and make sure they're true. And that's the other thing is you can read a lot of books, but I would always get a couple of validations before putting that on a note card as the truest answer you could give.
So there's fake news out there.
Not fake news, but I mean, don't let the facts ruin a good story sometimes. So it's just, you know, you're
the first person ever. I didn't realize that Munich was mostly making Dunkel styles until the late 1800s.
Yeah.
It always sounded like, oh, they adopted, you know, Helles lagers.
Yeah, Helles lagers came. I mean, and from what I've read, you know, they said, well, wait a minute. And Spaten actually was the first brewery to do it. And they were one of the first breweries to really patent or try out refrigeration in their maturation cellar. So, you know, about 5 years later, all the big six had Munich Helles. And now you only see Dunkels every so often there in there. If you go to a beer garden or the English gardens and Munich, you probably see people drinking a lot of Weissbier and a lot of Dunkel.
Yeah,
Helles. Or excuse me, Helles, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe some Americans that are over there that listen to the show said, I'm going to try a Dunkel for the first time.
I tell you, if you're in Munich, you have to try some Dunkel.
Any
shout-outs to American Dunkels? I'm shouting out to Sly Fox in Pennsylvania. They always sneak in a Dunkel that you can get maybe once a year.
We're in St. Louis a decent amount. Urban Chestnut makes a good one. I want to say it's Dorf Beer is maybe the brand name, but they make a pretty good Dunkel.
It is a style that if you go to a brewery and once you read through the 12 IPAs that are on, if you see Munich Dunkel or Alt Beer or a few other styles, try that one first because it's probably worth your while.
That's a great point. And the second beer we're drinking, what is it?
Sure. So it looks like we have a little Wicked Weed. This is a Brett beer fermented with a few different tropical fruits. Get some pineapple, some passion fruit, some mango, and a little bit of grapefruit. So this one's nice. I mean, to me, I get a lot of like lemongrass, like lemon peel, a lot of pineapple, a little bit of mango. Still has that nice kind of chalky, sweet tart, lactic character, but it's still pretty drinkable.
Yeah, there's definitely some nice Brett. Almost a hint of leathery hiding underneath the surface, but it's fantastic in the aroma and mouthfeel and flavor for sure.
This is great, man. I appreciate the taste so far. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. So this is the Beer Quiz with Massa Cicerone show. These guys really do know a lot, and I'm really happy to be here. We've been talking about getting Massa Cicerones on for a while, and they really do know what they're talking about, and, you know, beer is kind of getting up there with wine, you know, wine sommeliers, and people are going to know what a Cicerone is soon if they don't already. So we got Max and Ryan. So our next subject, we've covered a couple of points. Let's just talk about the test. So the Master Cicerone test is notoriously grueling. It's 2 days. There's written oral exams and tastings. So, but some of the people that are proctors who are doing the exams are really well-known people in the beer industry. So why don't you guys talk about a couple of those people?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because it might make it worth your while. You might want to take the test just to meet some of them.
Yeah, no, it's... and a lot of the people you see, you're like, I read two books by you before I even sat in this chair in front of you. I have to say, the first proctor I had was Jennifer Tolley out of Auburn Ale House. She just wrote a fantastic book on session beers, which...
Love that book.
Just came out. Yeah. I highly, highly recommend reading that. Fantastic, great homebrew recipes at the end as well, and... You know, the first oral interview I had with her was about fermentation, and this is the first time I took the exam, and the best way I could say it was verbal diarrhea. And she kind of said, calm down, you know, we're just talking about a fermenter here, and then I kind of got a second bearing, but she giving me that kind of like, hey, it's just a test thing, and me going back and talking about fermenters or bright tanks or something helped me out. And then I also, in my first attempt, sat in front of the, you know, world-famous Mitch Steele. Which I'd love to have some beers with him outside of that environment, but
so he's
former brewmaster of Stone, and just opened a new project down in Atlanta called New Realm, brewing some great beers down there. So that was, it's interesting because you know, you they present the court when you get there on the first day, and you know, like, oh man, I'm gonna have to answer any question from the syllabus or whatever they pull out of their hat about whatever, you know, water, malt, IPAs, you know, Mitch Steele asked you a question on IPAs. Probably not going to be able to.
They have to brush up on it too before the test, I'm sure, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're all studying.
You can't use the Webster's Dictionary defines an IPA as your answer. But so it was fantastic. I know Ryan had a few different people when he took it.
Yeah, I would say, you know, just from the format itself, I mean, 2 days long, you mentioned written, you're doing 12 different oral exams, 8 different tasting exams. And to me, you can never look kind of behind you. You know, you're whatever you're doing, if you make a little mistake, you can't stop and be like, oh, crap, you know, I just messed this up. My day's done. The test is done. You just got to kind of stay in the moment and just plow through. It's an absolute gauntlet. Because, yeah, you know, you're going to walk into one room and there's Ray Daniels. We call him AKA Mr. Cicerone, just sitting there. And, you know, he's a really nice guy, but he doesn't give you much emotion when you're doing an exam with him. And, you know, he'll grill you for 10, 15 minutes. Then you walk out, you walk into the next room and there's Randy Mosier. And he wants to talk beer and food. And you're like, okay, well, sure. I've read a few of your books and you obviously know your stuff. So the proctors are... I mean, the leaders of our industry, I mean, they're the people that we learn from, that we've read their books. I had Steve Homburg on Cask, Steve Parks on Brewing, Dick Cantwell.
Who's Steve Homburg?
He does a lot of work around cask beer, real ale. You know, Cask is a part of the keeping and serving portion of the syllabus. So certainly fair game for the exam. Really nice guy. I was fortunate to actually have a few beers with him after the test. You know, so yeah, it's one of those things where you have to know your stuff. These aren't guys that or ladies that you're gonna just start to spew a bunch of verbal diarrhea at, and they're gonna say, okay, well, that sounded good. You know, it either hits the mark or it doesn't. So it's daunting, but I would also say this: it's doable.
Yeah, it's definitely it's sitting in front. It's like a job interview. They're sitting in front of Ray Daniels, and instead of getting a question, tell me about your greatest accomplishment. He's gonna say, you know, tell me about a dark mild. And you're going to be like, you know, Ray, that was the one thing I didn't think you were going to ask me today. So
so I studied it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's get some tougher questions. So this is, we're going to try to go through these quickly. Okay, wow, these are tough questions. Keeping and serving beer, since you mentioned that. I'm just reading these randomly. Justin put these together. What aspect of beer labeling is most useful in assessing the freshness of beer? Okay.
Oh, good one.
Got my glasses on.
Yeah, I'd say a Best Buy date is definitely going to be the most consumer friendly.
Yeah, Best Buy, Born on, Julian date. Also, if you're in a store and it's the middle of summer and it says, you know, pumpkin ale, you just got to figure out what month it is, and it probably isn't the freshest beer on the shelf. So.
Well, maybe it's August and they released it.
Maybe,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Look at your date.
So Best Buy, David, you got to give us buzzer. That's a buzzer up. Okay, yeah. Good one. All right, another one. We're going to try to knock these out. The box you might see outside the beer cooler that is supplied with both carbon dioxide and nitrogen gas and has an output labeled 25% CO2.
I'm going to go blender box.
What is a blender box, generator, yeah. Alex?
So for the master exam, what they're going to do is mess that up. They'll probably turn the valves off, empty the CO2. They're gonna do something to put the gremlin in the system. So that you know,
will you actually have to handle the system?
Yeah, they're
so it's not just an oral question.
So when you do your keeping and serving, so your draft kind of assessment, you know, you're gonna have somebody like Neil Witt, who helped co-write the BA draft quality manual, and he's gonna say, you have 8 minutes to make this draft faucet pour beer at a flow rate of 2 ounces a second. The Kegram's back there, and you got to run. It's kind of like supermarket sweep almost. you're trying to get the turkeys and the high dollar bottoms first, and then you run, and you either works or it doesn't. And you go back and you continue your troubleshooting.
All right, another one. What is the best way to dry beer glasses, and what item or equipment is required?
You need some type of mat. It's off the bar surface. So you need some type of airflow. If you put it straight on, you're going to get potential chance for mold as the moisture accumulates in there. So some type of mat is the best use for drying beer glasses.
Yeah. Mat, wire rack.
Yeah.
These are the questions I wasn't going to ask you, but since we got them, we're going to keep going.
Keep them coming.
All right. So if I can read them. What is the name of the wood or plastic plug inserted into a cask and through which it will be tapped?
That'd be the Keystone.
Yeah, I'm going to go Keystone as well.
Keystone for 800.
It's not a spigot. That's something different.
So, yeah, the Keystone is where you're going to drive the tap into the cask. And then you have, you know, the bunghole up on the top, which if we have an opportunity to say bunghole on your show, we're going to take it.
Oh, wow. Also referred to as the belly hole. And then you could have the shiv. Some people say shive. Yeah.
There's the shiv and the bunghole. And,
and the tut.
Then you're on the next level, Ryan.
So. I mean, we have been drinking, so let's just go there.
All right, let's keep going. This could be a new show, the Master Cicerone Beer Quiz, which is pretty awesome. Beer styles. Okay. Carbonation levels in beer are commonly represented by what measure?
So in the U.S., we say volumes of CO2. This could be grams per liter. And this isn't probably one of the most interesting facts of beer that most average consumers don't know is, you know, it's 2.5 volumes is 2.5 equal size vessels. So this, you know, cold Presidente I'm sipping on here next to this Jester King, this probably has 2.5 volumes of CO2, meaning there's, when this is capped, there's 2.5 bottles worth of CO2 in here. And that's why we always pour beer into a glass to make that foam release. So we knock out some of that CO2. Also, beer without foam is not beer. So always pour beer into a glass.
Wow.
Amen.
What are we drinking? Is it Jester King?
Yeah. So nice. part of our privileges traveling around talking about beer is being able to stow suitcases and bring back beer. So this is Jester King Figlet, farmhouse ale fermented with smoked Texas figs. Fantastic beer. One that has a little bit of that, you know, leathery barnyard smoke.
I love this. Each one of these questions is a whole show. So you guys are coming back. We're going to do this again. Okay, more questions. We got, this is a style name question. Fill in the style name described by each phrase.
Oh, that's a good one.
A beer that, thank you, Justin. Justin did this. A beer that, I just can't read the print. A beer that contains, you have to read the questions. Lacey.
I have to read the questions.
I joked about it, but that's. You really should. So read the one.
We will say really quick
style.
About these questions. We had some copywriters take our course, and we were very much yelled at for having sentences end with prepositions. So,
okay,
if we're listening out there,
ready? Lightning round. A beer that contains no roast or black malts and is often the strongest of English ales is
English barley wine.
I would agree.
I don't have the answers, but it sounds good.
All right, next one. Do a couple.
Okay. This is pale good. Lager created and consumed in Munich. I think we've been talking about this one.
Mm.
That's my spirit beer. That spirit would be a Munich Helles.
Got to give that to Max. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Straight, unblended, spontaneously fermented wheat-containing ale from Brussels.
It's going to be a lambic.
Oh, yeah. One of my faves.
We used to say the question one more time.
Oh, yeah. Straight, unblended, spontaneously fermented wheat-containing ale from the Brussels region. The lambic, Ryan. I believe is what you said.
Lambic.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is good. Keep going, Lacey. I like this. I'm
okay.
Learning something.
Ready? A lager made with a grist of 30 to 40% corn or rice.
So, just a lager? I mean, that's a open question.
Lager,
so that could be either an American lager or American light lager. Depending on the ABV and bitterness units.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And one more, and then I'm going to ask a serious
one more
question.
Best known Irish beer style made with roast barley. Can I hear it?
Yeah, world famous Irish stout.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. Irish dry stout. Now, I'm just just to go on a final, like, nice conversation before we go. That was a great beer quiz. Thank you, Justin and Lacey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're talking about language. We had a great conversation before about, you know, descriptive words. You know, when you talk about fermentation, you know, what's going on there? Yeast, there's ale versus lager. One thing that's interesting is how do you talk to people about sour beers? You know, like there's wild, there's sour, there's Brett. You know, is that How do you talk to people about that as educators?
Sure. Well, I think one is just assigning a little bit of a level of intensity to the acidity or the sourness of the beer, just to brace somebody, no pun intended, for what they're about to experience. Sour on its own, I think, can be a little abrasive or off-putting. But like Max said, is it sour, like Greek yogurt? Is it like lemon juice? Is it like
Warheads,
acetic, yeah. You know, candy-like sour, tart? So there's kind of the basic taste element of that question.
Wait, Max, what did you say?
Warheads.
Warheads?
Kid, the candy kids eat.
Like lemon like lemon warheads.
See, I don't know.
Yeah, and then...
I know about horse plant.
Yeah. And then you can get into the flavor realm of, you know, certainly if there's bacteria, you can get into one or multiple flavor spaces. If there's wild yeast, you know, that's going to take us back into some of that wild, funky stuff we've been talking about. So... You know, I think you just want to kind of frame up and paint the best picture you can for somebody of what they're about to experience using as much descriptive language as we can. And then ultimately you want them to taste it and kind of see what they get out of it.
There's also sometimes just asking people questions like, what do you drink? Do you drink kombucha? No. Okay. Probably not going to start you off here. Do you like Greek yogurt? I mentioned that a few times. Same thing translates to bitterness with coffee. I just asked somebody the other day, you drink coffee? And they said, I like coffee with a lot of sweetener and a lot of creamer. And I said, you probably don't like very bitter beers, do you? And they said, absolutely not. So, but they like a little bit of bitterness. So it's finding that level. And then that's the base. And then once you have your base, you build up.
You compared it to me like white or red wine too, right? Like, oh, I like a floral white or I like a rich red. You can kind of pair.
Yeah.
It with
I mean, it's, to bring people into the category, it's, if you start them off on something that you like and you probably it's not going to be their cup of tea or cup of beer for the first time. It's finding the thing that is in their space at that time in that place. Mm. Start them off there, and then before they know it, they're going to be, you know, hoarding beer in their basement. So
yeah, and I think the best way, you know, Max mentioned this earlier, using just food as the analogy. If you just talk to people about what they really enjoy eating and drinking on a regular daily basis, and then you kind of start to uncover what those flavors are. And that's one of the beauties about beer is whether it's, you know, a malt forward beer, hop forward beer, fermentation forward beer, there's going to be a flavor that somebody's going to find that they love. They just might not have discovered it at this point.
Or may have not known it was in a beer.
That's cool. You know, and for what you guys are doing as beer educators, I mean, do you think, what is the goal with your knowledge? I mean, like, let's say we're talking about sour beer. Is it that every account out there has the exact wording on a beer list so that everyone can answer it, even if the bartenders aren't educated? I mean, how far can this education go? Or do you think that everyone just across the board will be picking up on better language, better knowledge?
For me, it's that when somebody describes a beer, they describe it in the best possible light. The worst thing ever is to say, hey, what's that taste like? And people go, it's super bitter. You wouldn't like it. Because right, if I'm a non-beer drinker, I'm going to say, well, it's super bitter. I'm not going to like it. But to say, oh, it's a, you know, using, we say qualitative versus quantitative. So it's got a pronounced bitterness. It's kind of like arugula, or it's kind of like, you know, black espresso. Giving beer the best possible chance. Because a lot of times people want to order beer on their first call or maybe their second call. And sometimes they're persuaded not to because of how it's described. Or maybe the person that's selling and says, I don't like it, right? So, you know, it's our job to say, if you don't like it, you should at least know how to describe it, because, you know, not everyone likes it.
I'll give that, said something really great. I'll give that credit to beer. I think one thing that's happened with wine, and the exception is like the new natural wine movement, which I'm a big fan of. So much of wine has become this international styles. You know, there's certain types of reds, certain type of whites, and you can make it whether it's Slovenia or Australia. There's not a lot of variation, but they have the styles down. And I think that's great for the market and for consumers as well. But I like that beer is still in that phase where you've got country styles. I didn't know how to describe a lambic until you read that question to me, Lacey. So how do you see where beer is going? You think that beer is going to become more international stylized, or you think that there's room for people to be open to tastes and descriptions?
I think there's a ton of opportunity for people just to discover what's going on with beer right now. We kind of take it for granted because we work in the industry. I mean, a lot of times I'm traveling the country with Max, who knows more about beer than most people I have ever met. So if I'm talking about beer with him, everything seems like, oh, of course we know everything about what's happening in all these flavors. But I think for the majority of people out there, we kind of take for granted that they should know this or they may know this where they really don't. And I think that's really our role and our goal as Master Cicerones is ultimately getting more people interested in beer. If you don't think there's a beer that you like, you just haven't found it yet, or if you've dipped your toe in and you maybe haven't had the best experience, we just haven't gotten you to the right place yet. Yeah. And that's what I really like about what I've learned, and hopefully what we can do moving forward is, you know, just getting more and more people
and
excited about beer.
The whole industry, yeah. Right? I mean,
so one thing I learned from a former brewmaster named George Rice, who was kind of one of my early mentors, is he mentioned to me the rule of three. You really have to have it three times in a full capacity to make that decision if you like it or you don't like it. So sometimes trying something once, maybe not even the right ambiance, you don't want to be too quick to judge. You want to have a beer to sit on the couch and really get into it. And then if you don't like it after the third one, it's not your cup of tea. But if you do,
and then where did you know George Rice?
He was a mentor. When I was doing sales out in California, he came out and did some events, and he's been all around the country. Used to be kind of us in a sense for Anheuser-Busch, but smart guy and third generation brewer. His family had a brewery in around Springfield, Illinois, so it was in his blood. So he was the most passionate person I've ever met about beer, which is you can know a lot, but if you don't have passion,
cheers to
if you, George Rice. If you know a lot, but you don't have passion about what you're talking about, then people aren't going to care. So.
And Ryan, you want to give a shout out to someone? Because we're going to wrap up in a few minutes.
Maybe I'll give a shout out to Max, the guy sitting across from me. I definitely learned a ton from a lot of people, but Max was kind of the one that, you know, showed me a lot of the way and really kind of guided me as I dug in through the Master Cicerone journey. And very, very sure I would not have passed in the first try if it wasn't for Max.
And Lacey, what's it like working with these guys?
Oh, my gosh. Well, every day is a hoot and a holler sitting across from this guy over here, Max. And I wish I could sit next to you more, Ryan, but it's great. I learned so much from you guys.
So one guy's in New York City, one guy's in Buffalo. You guys are the talk of the town. Bow down before you. And I'm actually now going to be intimidated by Master Cicerones. I really feel like you guys know your stuff, and we're going to talk more with you guys. And thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for
having us. We sincerely appreciate it. Big shout out. What's coming up? We got July Good Beer Month is in the works. It's the 10th year. It's something that's been around. It predated, you know, Brewers Guild and all that, but it's still going to happen. July 18th, New York City Brewers Choice. Some fun stuff's going on in New York City. Thanks again for joining us. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer David Tatasciore. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.